Look at your contacts now. They're right there on your smartphone. Click through them, one at a time. Are you seeing a pattern? You probably don't need to be a sociologist to grasp that your contacts list very likely represents a high degree of, let's just call it, racial uniformity. I mean, here's an experiment. Invite the people on your list to an imaginary party. What faces will you see?
It's a world of laughter, world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we are aware. It's a small, small world.
Okay, fine, maybe you're an exception, that's nice. But you would be the rare exception. The findings in an actual survey conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute says it would be a very monochromatic party indeed. Blacks, in fact, are 10 times more likely to have white friends than whites are to have non-white friends. And 3/4 of white Americans, according to the survey, have not one but zero non-white friends. Is there any excuse for that?
This is Matt calling from Portland, Oregon. Sometimes I find that the environment that you're in sometimes isn't connotative to being around diverse individuals. Sometimes your hobbies or job just causes you to be surrounded by people of light color.
This is Roman calling from Redmond, Washington. I was lucky enough to go to a very diverse public junior high school, Richmond Heights Junior in Miami, Florida. And I was also lucky enough to keep many of these friends all my life. And I think this is one of the reasons why I have friends of many different backgrounds.
A lot of you from the Pacific Northwest really wanted to weigh in on this subject. It's a sample of your responses from that region to this idea. But let's go national. Let's dig into these numbers. We turn now to Arun Venugopal, host of the podcast Micropolis. Hey, Arun.
Hey, John.
So is this a real shocker, all this sort of bubble sociology that we apparently are condemned to live?
If you'd asked me even a few days ago, I might have been mildly shocked. But the thing is that, you know, a lot of us are looking at Ferguson these days. And, you know, I've been kind of digging into these, you know, what is the reality across America in these neighborhoods, in these suburbs? A lot of them are like Ferguson. I mean, and the data on this is going to kind of confirm what you've been talking about here, which is that, you know, whites and blacks live in very different worlds. And I know that sounds like, yeah, no kidding, Arun. But basically, let's just look at the data that this scholar, John Logan, he's a sociologist at Brown University. He dug through the 2010 census data. And let's just talk about the typical white person, okay? Typical white person lives in a neighborhood that is 75% white, okay? There's 8% black, 11% Hispanic, 5% Asian. That's the typical white neighborhood. The typical black person, on the other hand, lives in a neighborhood that is 45% black and 35% white, 15% Hispanic, 4% Asian. So there's a lot more white people that are in the typical black neighborhood than there are black people in the typical white neighborhood. So you're talking about the people they really rub up against in their daily lives, the schools that they go to, and probably, I'm guessing, the extent to which they're comfortable dealing with people of different races, you know? I mean, Logan has been doing this for 40 years, and he said when he set out in the 60s doing this, he was like, oh yeah, things are going to change real fast. And he's like, you know, now I realize that things are pretty bleak.
Every decade, I have reason to think that now things are changing, opportunities are opening up, black middle class is expanding. Whites are changing their attitudes. They're in all the survey research, it shows that they're less resistant to having a black neighbor. And by golly, we elected a black president. So by 2010, you might have thought that we'd see better outcomes than this, but actually the color line turns out to be extremely persistent.
You know, and it's persistent on so many levels. I was looking at the New York Times front page, and here's that, you know, typical story of the cop in Ferguson and then Michael Brown on the other side. And it's, you know, two different worlds. And I, you know, read that and I said, oh, good journalism. But then I said, but why do we accept this? Why do we just accept that that's a reality? And I think kind of we do. And that's what these stats show.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that people are talking about, like, Ferguson is going to be the thing that really, like, I think Sharpton, Al Sharpton was there yesterday, Reverend Sharpton at the funeral saying, we have to make sure we don't just sit around and just talk about this. But actually making that difference, I mean, who knows what's going to happen a month from now? A lot of these incidents, they happen in neighborhoods across America, and they reflect also different degrees to which we interpret these situations. You know, Ferguson, black people are like, yeah, this is a really big deal. This is, you know, reflects a huge problem. White people are much less likely to think that. They think a lot more likely to think that, okay, enough, or enough of Ferguson. And so they're, you know, they have different worldviews.
What do you say to the listener who says, just enough already? It's a free country. We live wherever we want to live. Just get over it.
Actually, we don't necessarily live where we want to live. The fact is, these neighborhoods, they're not just like free market playing out the way it's supposed to. There were laws, there were zoning regulations, there continue to be all kinds of ways in which people have been sort of shunted into neighborhoods, maybe against their will, or if you're white, it's the way you like to. In the 50s and 60s, the Mad Men era, you see those beautiful suburbs. I think for a long time we thought, oh, that's just the way that it is. They're lovely. But actually, they're noticeably lacking in diversity. And that's for very good reasons, because they were made that way.
Institutional choices, institutional issues that we're now seeing reaping the psychological and social consequences of.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we think of this as maybe a parlor game. Hey, how many friends do you have in another race? It's a little funny, a little embarrassing. But, you know, you look at other countries. People have done research on this. In cities, say, in India, Hindu-Muslim violence is considered this terrible thing. And experts have looked at this. Ashutosh Varshney, who's also from Brown University, like John Logan before, he said, like, you know, the cities where it exploded were the cities where people were not interacting, where Hindus and Muslims were not hanging out with each other.
Does Logan suspect that there is a social cost in the sense that pressures are rising and that Ferguson, triggered by a shooting, is something that would be revisited and maybe wouldn't require a shooting to have the same sort of tension play out on the streets?
Well, I mean, he certainly thinks that Ferguson is not unusual. This is a typical suburb, you know, in terms of statistically. It's poorer than the other neighborhoods in Missouri, the typical neighborhoods. It's you know, got higher crime and that kind of a thing. It's a suburb that used to have a lot of white people. Those white people left. You know, it used to be very white. And in the last 30 years, it's now very black. So a lot of people think that this is not unusual. This can happen in other places.
Arun Venugopal is host of WNYC's Micropolis. What makes American friendships so segregated?
I'm Charlie. I'm calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. De facto segregation, we naturally gravitate to those with similar cultures and backgrounds, and in most cases, those with the same skin color is the reason why I feel that three-fourths of white Americans don't have any non-white friends.
This is Ruth from Canton, Ohio, and I have several friends of several different races, but I also live in a very racially diverse area, and I choose to live here.
This is Barbara. I'm from Jersey City. I was raised in suburban New Jersey in an all-white suburb all through high school. But what I would say is now I live in Jersey City, which is a deeply diverse community, and I have constant contact with people of color from all over the world, which gives me a lot of comfort and confidence. But those years of being the only black woman was deeply diminishing, and I avoid it at all costs right now. I always try to be in settings where there's diversity in economics, in sexual orientation, in race, ethnicity, and while it's essential, it's survival for me, but I also would challenge white folks who live in Jersey City to make an effort.
Weigh in on this subject. We'd love to know what you think. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.